Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. The U.S. COVID death toll is now at nearly 600,000. As cases level off and the nation rapidly moves toward normalcy, even though only about 50% of the nation has been vaccinated. Concern there is that new variants as they entered the United States could actually fan an increase among those who are not protected against the virus. Denmark and Norway are reopening, and all eyes are on whether the European Union will move to reopen on the 15th, which would become effective on July the 1st, and Britain on the 21st will return to the normalcy that national leaders have hoped. The G7, hosted by British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, met in the lovely Cornish seaside town of Carbis Bay, agreeing to distribute more than 1 billion vaccinations worldwide, half of which would come from the United States. The meeting comes about a week and a half after leading powers agreed to a new global tax structure to eliminate multinationals from dodging their obligations in tax havens. Johnson and Joe Biden signed an updated Atlantic Charter to reinvigorate democracies against the rising global tide of authoritarianism. And Biden has tried to focus the G7 on better standing up to China. Nations remain divided on a number of initiatives, including Build Back Better for the World, B3W, to counter Beijing's Belt and Road. Biden meets next week with NATO leaders before finishing his trip in Geneva with his first one-on-one with Vladimir Putin. Brexit tensions have flared over the Irish border question, which we've been discussing for some time. Former IAG chief Willie Walsh thinks that United's move toward a new era of supersonic travel is just plain stone cold stupid. Joining us to discuss all of that and more, including Rafales for Switzerland, as well as the call by NATO's Supreme Allied Commander to bring together the multiple next generation air dominance aircraft programs, are Dr. Rocket Ron Epstein of Bank of America Merrill Lynch, Sash Tusa of the independent equity research firm Agency Partners in London, and Richard Abalafia of the Thiel Group Consultancy here in Washington, D.C. Gentlemen, thanks very much for joining us.
Pleasure to be here, Vago. Thanks.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure, Vago. Thank you.
Good to be on with you, Vago. Thanks.
It's terrific, and the cicada drone, I think, is a little bit quieter because we had such furious rain here over the past couple of days. I think the poor little buggers are still drying out. Before we get started, Leonardo DRS sponsors our global coverage, Northrop Grumman, our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall, Fincantieri, Marinette Marine, our naval coverage, General Atomics Aeronautical Systems, our coverage of strategy, and General Motors Defense, our technology coverage. And please check out our Cavas Ships podcast with none other than our contributing editor, Chris Cavas, and our producer, Chris Cervello, who talk about global naval developments on a weekly basis. Ron, start us off. Give us a tour of world markets. Certainly an interesting week. Everybody's back from, obviously, from Memorial Day. That's sort of long worn off at this point. But also looking at this global tax deal and what does it mean? Some expectations about the G7 and what they would be up to. Give us your sense on where we are as parts of the world reopen and other parts of the world, unfortunately, are still gripped in pandemic hell.
Yeah, sure. So the S&P for the week was essentially flat, was up about 40 basis points. And then if you look at the aerospace defense stocks and as bellwethers, Northrop Grumman for defense, it was down about 60 basis points. Boeing was down about 100 basis points. And so, you know, broadly, the A&D group underperformed the S&P by call about 1%. The champion on the week was Embraer, which was up 20%, just under 20% on the news that leaked that their Eve division that is working on an eVTOL aircraft could potentially be spun into a SPAC. And that got the shares of Embraer going this week. When you look at the interest rate markets, they pulled back a bit. So, you know, interest rates are somewhere between 1.4 to 1.5 percent on the 10-year. And oil prices and other commodities are steadily climbing. So if you look at WTI crude, sort of generic WTI, it's already pushing over 70, almost 72, in fact, at this point. So kind of the same themes that we've been seeing here for the last couple of weeks. Inflation kicking higher, the interest rate market actually very steady, and the market essentially flat. So it's, you know, here we are. I think we're in beginning the midst of the summer doldrums on the group. I think that the G7 on the market broadly, I don't think much of it had much of an impact on the market.
Right.
We didn't see things move on, you know, kind of the global tax regime and so on and so forth. So I think that's where we are.
You know, I think it's interesting that Boeing was still down, even though it claims that it sold those 100 Maxes, right, that folks had backed out on. Wasn't that interesting to you that the shares were still somewhat soft despite that news?
Well, it's, you know, the, how do I say this? At first Max orders got the shares going, but the market just kind of gets immune to that sort of stuff because it starts discounting the fact that that's going to happen. And then right. You know, and when you look at, I think you're referring to what the 100 Max 7s to Southwest, you know, it's just more Maxes to the same customer. So it's right. Not that that's a bad thing, but I think the market kind of discounts that. My sense, what would really get the shares going, if you saw an Airbus customer switch to the Max, something right. like that. And we haven't seen that yet. Not that we won't at some point, but we just haven't seen that yet.
Sash, talk to us a little bit about the European reopening, right? Denmark and Norway encouraging, Portugal already open, although traffic flow is slowing down a little bit. A lot of concerns about what happens in the UK and the June 21 date, as we've discussed, right? I mean, everybody in your great nation was looking to do the big reemergence, then members of parliament eager to get back to work as normal. And that looks like it might not be the case. Give us kind of a macro view on where we are.
First of all, sort of caveat I give pretty much every week, which is that when we talk about reopening in Europe, we're talking about reopening on a country-by-country basis and not a country-to-country basis. So individual countries can open up, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you can actually fly to them or from them. You know, Portugal is probably the exception in that. I mean, speaking from a UK point of view, you can fly to Portugal and you can fly back. And there are not very, you know, that's a pretty simple process. But if you fly to Spain or, you know, which is clearly completely adjacent, you fly back 10 days quarantine. And that's not going to change for another month, 2 months, 3 months, just so, you know, Italy and France is closed to UK travel, period. And so France could technically reopen internally, and it would have no effect on travel between France and any other country in Europe. In that respect, it's very different to the US, where once you open up your domestic travel setup, which is far bigger than European domestic travel, because European domestic travel is really only a bit in Spain, a bit in Germany, and a bit in France, you know, the geographically large, long countries, Norway as well, I suppose. And domestic travel is a tiny percentage of European travel itself. So, nobody in the UK is talking about Denmark and Norway reopening, frankly, because it doesn't mean anything here. And the UK was looking to open up internally, i.e. to reduce restrictions like face masks, like capacity at indoor events and so forth. I was looking to open up on the 21st of this month. It's not going to happen. Boris Johnson's, you know, pretty much acknowledged that, probably going to be delayed by at least a month. Does that change very much? Not really. You know, you can go to a restaurant, you can, and, you know, restaurants are absolutely full in the UK. Everybody's traveling, everybody's holidaying domestically in the UK this year, as far as we can work out. The prices to rent somewhere in the UK, like, for example, Carbis Bay, have doubled compared to last year, you know, captive market. But, you know, if you're an airline and the European and to some extent US airlines are whinging like stink about this, and they're going to have to suck it up because nobody is interested in protecting them and taking risk on international reopening and new variants coming in.
Well, it certainly is good news, right, for Brighton, Blackpool, the Cornish Riviera, right, Torquay and all of that, you know, having a little bit of a domestic resurgence. And it's lovely to see Brits going to these traditional seaside resorts.
Just resorts. I mean, no, but there are non-resort, unbelievably beautiful parts of the British coast as well. And,
Absolutely.
And indeed, you know, hill areas and so forth inland. So it's actually going to make for very, very good GDP numbers this year.
Do some hiking and stay at one of those extraordinary little cottages. That would be my recommendation. Although I suspect that I'm not the only guy who thinks that would be a lovely way to spend a bit of vacation. Speaking of vacation, Richard, you guys are your family vacation is a go. So everybody is very, very happy about it. But talk to us a little bit more broadly. You and Ron spoke at the Speed News conference. You did so in person, which was really great. So both of you made the pilgrimage out to LA for that. Walk us through some of the key elements and how you guys interpret that. And Ron, want to get your sense as well, because that is a very important conference that's happening at a time when things are right. The prognosis is getting brighter than darker.
Yeah. Thanks for the appreciation of our holiday coming up. And it just happenstance that about a year ago, my wife and I started planning for Denmark and Norway, and it looks like we got incredibly lucky. So good with the good news with that. Speed News was fascinating because, you know, Joanna Speed, the person in charge, kind of was approaching it tentatively. Will it be a hybrid virtual and live event? She eventually decided that no, just go full throttle live, no virtual. And it was oversubscribed, you know, because they've got capacity restrictions in Los Angeles. Normally about 400 people or so showed up. I think it was capped at like 230 or something like that. And there was a waiting list. And people were eager to come. And that was just, of course, from U.S. attendees. I think there were only one or two international folks who were able to come. If the usual complement of Europeans and Asians had been allowed to show too, it would have been even more oversubscribed. I think there was so much enthusiasm for a return to in-person conferences. And, you know, having done a number of these, pretty much on a weekly basis, you know, VidCons with groups of folks, and of course, a daily basis with clients or whatever. I can't tell you how it was just like a weight lifted off to not have to look at people through a screen and to be able to interact with them off hours and whatever else. I mean, it kind of contributes to my impression that we're going to come back 100% on business travel. Might not stay that way, but at least the rebound is going to be extremely strong, feeding into my expectation that we're going to have a recovery to the 2019 travel peak by late 2022. I know I'm still kind of out on a limb on this, but I feel more secure than ever. Most of the talk, not surprisingly, focused on single aisle production rates in response to this comeback and a general appreciation that Airbus was probably going to get some, if not all, of the way there. That, you know, basically what was going on was a kind of elaborate stress test for their supply chain, as well as, you know, a good way to make the supply chain healthy by implying that they've got big fortunes ahead. Boeing, not so much, but heading in the right direction at least, and so much dependent upon China, possibly including Airbus's ability to gain incremental market share at Boeing's expense. So I guess it was a conference about business travel and single aisle production rates, and very well attended and quite a welcome development.
Ron?
What I would add to Richard's commentary, you know, for sure, had they put tickets on StubHub, they would have gone at a premium. the on the supplier side, there was a lot of supplier, you know, conversations around just worries on, you know, okay, if we have this ramp in front of us, how do we pay for it? You know, ultimately, you know, a lot of the suppliers who got through the worst of this, you know, their balance sheets got stretched. In the case of Boeing, their balance sheet got stretched. It was interesting. Some of, you know, one of the questions I got asked by one of the suppliers was, you know, hey, we had a contract with yet a smaller supplier, a machine shop that was doing work for us. We had an agreed to price and it was a long-term contract. They no longer exist. So when we redo that contract with somebody else, it'll be more expensive. You know, how do we pay for that? So, you know, I think it was, you know, clearly optimism around things getting better. But you know, kind of when you start peeling back some of the details for operationally, how the supply chain is going to pay for it and fund it, where's the working capital going to come from? You know, there was some stress around that, but, you know, broadly it was a good meeting, you know, very positive on narrow bodies, less so positive on wide bodies. And then, you know, still questions around China.
Sash, questions or observations for either Richard or Ron before we move on?
I agree with sort of Richard's takeaway that Airbus is very, very keen to stress test the supplier base and do it sooner rather than later. Just based on their backlog, they've got the backlog to start raising rates. Whether they've got the backlog to actually to get to 75, I rather doubt, 75 aircraft a month, that is. But I think that, you know, our numbers suggest that the market share gain from Boeing it has been achieved and is structural. And the issue is going to be, therefore, what Boeing has to do to regain any of that market share. And I think we've all argued this before, you know, it needs new programs, real new programs, and sooner rather than later.
And I just really quickly before we move on, Ron, because you said this wasn't really much of a market mover, is the global minimum tax deal a needle mover? Sash, for example, nations decided on 15%. And as I recall, Ireland is at 12.5. A lot of smaller nations saying, hey, look, we need to have a little bit of an edge for us to be competitive against bigger powers that might have some more economic flexibility, right? Can give bigger tax write-offs, et cetera. Or investment capital or what have you. How do you interpret this in terms of its broader impact on aerospace and defense?
Broader impact on aerospace and defense, actually relatively little, because although the supplier base is fairly broadly spread globally, and quite a lot of suppliers have got subsidiaries on other continents. So if you're a US supplier, you will have businesses in Europe predominantly to supply Airbus. If you're a European supplier, you will have businesses in North America, especially Mexico, to supply Boeing. But what they don't have is this very, very complicated transfer pricing and attribution of value to intellectual property and internal cross-subsidization and so forth that you have in the tech giants. This is really aimed at the tech companies. And if we look at the biggest companies in our coverage, they're predominantly single company or single continent businesses. You know, Airbus is a European company that happens to have a number of final assembly lines in China, Canada, and the US, but those are a tiny percentage of the value add of Airbus, the majority which is created and accounted and tax paid in Europe. Boeing, even less so. You know, Boeing's a US company, period. So I don't think this is something that actually affects the aerospace and defense industry. This is aimed at big tech, and there's every possibility that it will be more, you know, slightly successful, which, you know, as a taxpayer would be a good thing.
Ron?
Yeah, I agree 100% with what Sash said. I mean, when you look at the distribution of the aerospace supply chain in locations, and some of it has to do more with, you know, potentially labor rates in different countries, that sort of thing. But very little has to do with tax rules and tax. So, you know, the impact there is you're minimal. And then obviously defense in the US is vertically integrated in the US, and the same thing for Europe. So, the impact on our sector is pretty minimal.
On the G7, President Biden announcing that there is going to be a tougher line, that nations have agreed to get tougher with China. No coal deal. Obviously, climate was an important part of this. We have 1 billion vaccinations being promised by the G7, which is great, half of which would come from the United States in the form of the Pfizer vaccine. What do you guys see as takeaways from this event? Unfortunately, we've seen simmering and an increasingly toxic a relationship between not just the UK and the EU over Brexit, but also France and the UK, which is never a positive thing. What are as you guys look at these tea leaves, and as we're about to go into NATO, and we can talk about that in a minute, do you guys see anything interesting, thought worthy, noteworthy here for our sector? Sash? Or Ron, go ahead. 3, 2, 1, Ron.
Yeah, I'll just jump in and say, I mean, that, you know, continued tension between the U.S. and China for all the reasons we've talked about in the past, Boeing sort of held hostage in this whole thing. So it doesn't make one feel better that certification for the Max would be coming anytime sooner. And you know, it's the Max in China is about a third of the backlog. And on 787s, just to bear in mind, China historically anyway accounted for about two deliveries a month, right? So that's the difference between five per month and seven per month, or you know, nine or 11. You know what I mean? So on this one, unfortunately, you know, Boeing is in the crossfire.
Sash?
I've got nothing to add to Ron's comments on Boeing. I completely agree with those. I think, you know, more broadly, relations between the UK and other countries in Europe, I mean, the EU as an organization and France, you know, particularly, definitely came out of the G7 worse rather than better. And, you know, part of that is the UK's approach to the sort of the post-Brexit negotiations. Part of that is the is Macron's particular stress as he faces re-election next year. But, you know, the headlines are not good reading for people who want a relatively united, successful Europe, because, you know, I don't think people came away from the G7 feeling that in terms of the, you know, the national relationships that they were with the UK, they were that great.
But no particular aerospace and defense impact from your standpoint, right? I mean, are you concerned at all in the worsening tensions right on the upside? I know that Max Hastings criticized the new Atlantic Charter, but there are some who see that as a positive, right? The United States and the UK as sort of foundational democracies, adding their voice to it. I think the G7 underscored that. Macron in his comments talked about that as well, you know, about the importance of it. But broadly, is there a moment of danger now or not for the?
I don't see it as a moment of danger, and I think the implications for the sector are very, very long term. But you know, Airbus was a Franco-German creation into which the UK came very, very rapidly indeed, and you know, and Spain thereafter, and those four nations, arguably led by France, but you know, with very strong support from Germany, is the European civil aerospace industry. It's the most important part of the aerospace and defence industry. In Europe, poor relations between the UK and France in particular. I actually think we don't know what our relationship with Germany is going to be, because nobody knows what Germany is going to be after the October right. elections. We just don't know what the government's going to look like. But poor relations between the UK and France cannot help collaboration between European nations on a broader sense, you know, be it in missiles or satellites or launchers or military aircraft or civil aircraft.
Anybody else want to add to that?
Well, sure. I'd point out that it's becoming very clear that the one foreign policy hallmark of the Biden administration is a tougher stance on China. And a key part of that is establishing a united front. Unlike the Trump administration, where it was scattershot with lots of alienation of allies, this is a coherent effort to try to, you know, create a broader set of allies against, you know, China. And I think it was Kurt Campbell, Biden's key China advisor, who said, we're moving from an era of cooperation to competition. This is a very different environment. And I think from, you know, following on to Ron's comments, this represents effectively a multi-decade mega drought, possibly, for the jetliner business. And, you know, one of the interesting upshots of the G7 meeting to watch is, you know, going to be whether or not there will be a united front, which means that there's more likely to be some kind of agreement reached with China on aerospace and everything from Max recertification to orders to technology transfer shipments and whatever else, or whether or not Airbus and Europe are going to go their own way and basically reach some kind of accommodation with China. And the U.S. will be maintaining its hard stance, perhaps with help from Australia and Canada. But the upshot is that Airbus could easily see an increase in market share due to this strategic realignment resulting between China and the U.S.
I would point out that European nations appear to be on board. And in fact, the pressure, right, the administration has been coordinating defense budget planning as it was building its budget with all of its Asian as well as European allies. So there is this sense that everybody is going to be more on the chart than not. And we emerge from these meetings with really a global consensus for there to be a deeper investigation on the origins of the coronavirus. So that does not necessarily bode well for China and has actually prompted Beijing to soften its tone, recognizing, holy crap, we've dug ourselves a really deep hole with wolf warrior diplomacy and the rest of this crap. And now the whole world is organizing against us. So my curiosity is how quickly Beijing adapts to a softer tone to try to undermine that tougher message, and obviously then use good old-fashioned economic horsepower to bend people to its will. Sash, why don't you start us off, right? Very important NATO meeting. Jens Stoltenberg selling his vision, wanting higher dues to get to this future, a more capable future NATO. A lot of allies pushing back, France among them saying, okay, we're willing to spend more money, but what do you want to spend that more money on? And, you know, when you have American friends sort of agreeing with the folks in Paris, it's interesting, right? It's not a, you know, we had Jim Townsend on the program, the Europe director during the Obama administration, Europe director at the Pentagon, and it indicated that, you know, the alliance hasn't really made that case for more spending. On the other hand, we've heard a great message from Todd Walters, the Supreme Allied Commander Europe. Hey, let's bring the U.S. NGAD, British, Italian, Swedish Tempest, as well as the Franco-German, Spanish SCAF programs all together. Talk to us a little bit about some of what's going on that front and some expectations coming out of the NATO summit from your perspective. Or NATO meeting, right?
The summit meeting, yes. Yeah, I mean, NATO, first of all, I think what we've got here is the classic tension between within a federated structure. Does the spending get done at the local level, i.e. national defense budgets, or do they give money to the center, in this case NATO, to go and do central stuff? And there is always that tension in a federated structure. There's a lot of pushback at the moment at whether NATO is the best way to spend or the best route to spend some of the enabling money, or whether it is better spent by national on national capabilities that will deliver combat, logistics, power to NATO organizations further down the track. If you are a NATO Secretary General, of course you want to have a bigger budget, you know, because that's your personal budget as opposed to you going around telling everybody to spend more. But President Macron took it pretty badly. it was quite a reaction there. The French defense budget is very interesting because France is spending probably more on operations at the moment, predominantly in North Africa, than pretty much any other nation in Europe. And therefore, they have their own tensions. But, you know, they are doing an astonishing job, in some cases, pretty much all on their own. And I hugely respect them for it. But I can see why they don't feel they don't want to be spending or sending a lot more cash up to NATO and Mons at the moment.
I should just point out, right? To your point, we have NATO AWACS, NATO AGS, and the NATO Airlift Group. But the rest, right, there's very little else that NATO itself is buying because the member nations are the ones who cough up that capability. And as you mentioned, Barkhane, Macron last week said, look, we're going to have to consider what the mission is after this because, obviously because of the political disintegration in Mali, he's a little bit concerned that, look, we can do what we are doing, but absent some broader political settlement, we're not going to get anywhere. We're just sort of spinning our wheels, at the end of the day, and would have to reconstitute that mission. So I just wanted to point out that, you know, some of the other dynamics that are, you know, behind the scenes here.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And, France in particular, I think, is very concerned that having gone into Mali with a very, very clear intent, it suddenly becomes apparent that they're not just going to have to do, to defend Mali, but actually to reconstruct the entire political system. And they're not sure whether they've got the capacity to do that. And I think it's very honest of them to consider that as an issue right now. But clearly that is a problem for Operation Barkhane.
You guys have any other commentary before we get to the question of how we would integrate all of these national programs? That's a question I've been asking everybody from word go. on how all these programs get stitched together so we have an interoperable whole as opposed to a whole bunch of airplanes that need to be plumbed together rather than having been built together. Richard and Ron, let me bring you in on the plumbing of these programs together, and Sash, you as well, right? Very important programs from a national level. Obviously, Tempest is the repository of three great aviation nations' future aspirations. Same thing for SCAF. And obviously, the U.S. Air Force looking for the capability that will be the follow-on to the F-22 at this point, right? It's an air dominance aircraft. It is not a replacement for the F-35 in a strike capacity. So, we talked to Lieutenant General Thick. Our interview is going to be out tomorrow, the program executive officer for F-35, and it was a really thoughtful conversation. We discussed that element of the program a little bit. Richard, you want to start us off on the best way to make sure that this is a better integrated whole and maybe the role that NATO can play in doing that?
You know, it's going to be a major challenge for NATO. And I think now is the time to start because, you know, all of these programs kind of have their origins in the usual national-based thinking, you know, a level of competition for export orders, a strong level of nationalism and air power sovereignty, particularly for Tempest, much though I really like the idea. It's sort of embedded in, I guess, what you might call Brexit thinking, you know, take back control and all that sort of thing. And as well as, you know, an increasingly vertical level of alignment in terms of supply chains. So it's not like you've got multinational contractors that offer black boxes and networks that can cross borders easily. And then on top of that, you have these new generation programs that are going to be roped into new national air power teaming concepts that allow for new concepts of manned and unmanned systems talking to each other, like the Mosquito program in Britain or Air Power Australia, everything like that. That's going to further complicate the ability to connect all of these platforms and allow them to transfer data, targeting information, whatever else. So if NATO is going to be involved, they better start talking now before this becomes a major challenge. And God knows it, you know, you've just got a few more years of runway before things get set in stone.
Ron, from your standpoint, is it already perhaps too late to start making those kind of architectural decisions, given that some of these are being viewed as sort of national sovereignty programs?
I would expect not. I mean, you know, when you think about the length of the development of any one of these programs, it's still early days, right? So, you know, I would expect not that, you know, if there's a will, there's a way to do it, most certainly at this point.
Sash?
There is no will. It won't happen. End of. One of the things I thought was very, I was very surprised by the reaction to Sakur's comments this week from, I talked to you, military aviation industrialists in four of the six nations involved in the two big European programs. And to a person, their responses were, he's an American and he is trying to get us to, he's trying to break our programs and to achieve American dominance. So it was not seen by people in European industry as being a comment coming from NATO. It was seen as being a comment coming from the US. Almost trying to reverse the entire purpose of SCAF, FCAS, and Tempest, which is to try to rebuild or maintain national aviation capabilities.
I just want to push back on that. Anybody who knows Todd Walters knows that all, having discussed this issue with him before, he doesn't really care at all what anybody does at the end of the day, as long as what everybody does communicates with one another, right? And I think that is a very big misreading, or you're just talking your slide deck. He's not saying buy my airplane. He's saying make sure that all of us can cross connect and talk to one another. And from his standpoint, it's good that every nation does maintain skin in the game.
The
industrial capability.
The way that the comments on transparency was read, you know, very, very consistently over here was industrial transparency. You know, tell us what you are doing. And there was a feeling of, well, we never get told what you're doing. You know, you being right. The US. I mean, I report this because it was such a consistent response by industry, not because it's correct. Just talk about interoperability for a second, though. NATO interoperability is this, I mean, it's this holy grail. And people have, you know, searched for it high and low, and it, you know, it's somewhere out there on the horizon. NATO has only ever really achieved interoperability in four things. Three natures of ammunition, 5.56 millimeter, 7.62 millimeter, and 155 millimeter, which can all be fired by, you know, the respective things. And one beverage, coffee, milk with two sugars. There is no other NATO interoperability except in the things that really matter, which is tactics, techniques, and procedures. And if you get your TTPs right, i.e. if you train together, if you operate together, if you learn how the other, your other partners work, and actually if you accept, rejoice, and accommodate the fact they do stuff differently, you have a much stronger organization than if everybody is sort of clones of each other. And so I think it's great that we have an agreement on coffee. We've had it for about 45 years, probably more. But ammunitions are great. You can file them off as and when you need them. But TTPs are more important, particularly for combat air, than whether the aircraft are the same. Can they talk to each other? That's going to be an issue of data links, which actually is a very, very small part of the broader specifications for these air systems. I think that can be done. Building on Link 11 and Link 16 in particular, NATO has shown that can be done over decades. But I think to try to bring the programs further together actually really does alarm people, certainly some industrialists here in Europe at the moment, and it wasn't read correctly.
We're running short on time, but I will point out that I think what Todd is talking about, what General Walters is talking about, is it has to be more than just a Link 11. And the transparency issue is, if we're going to go to a JADC2, a Joint All Domain Command and Control network of purely seamless integration of data that flows from one thing to another thing, that goes beyond just getting the plugins right, which is what Link 16 is, we're looking at an order of magnitude jump. And when we do that order of magnitude jump, has always been the case, our European allies have a tendency of being a generation behind. And if you're looking at a quantum leap as what ABMS and JADC2 is going to be, there is a concern that we leap and then everybody, right? I mean, there are some people who are patting themselves on the back now, Sash, that, ooh, we got Link 16. I mean, okay, that's great, but we're already looking at the next standard. But it's illustrative to bear in mind how people are interpreting that comment to make sure that certainly the U.S. side makes it clear that this is not just a snatch and grab when it comes to technology. Let me quickly ask you about the Switzerland competition. Swiss Press, talk to us a little bit about what it means for the program for a new fighter to replace the F-18 in Swiss Air Force service.
Yeah, I mean, the Swiss are looking for around 40, maybe more fighters to replace their not just their F-18s actually, but also their F-5s. They've got a number of F-5 aircraft there, which look great when they're painted in white and red. I do sometimes wonder whether they're an act of war, but numbers matter. The competition is the usual F-35, F-18, Eurofighter Typhoon, Rafale, and several very influential Swiss newspapers this week said that all of the evidence shows that this is going to Rafale. There's all sorts of actually quite good reasons for that. The Swiss requirement is for air policing. They have, the French have offered to effectively create a common air policing zone where the command and control would effectively come from Switzerland. And that's been taken very well. Thales has been selling air defense command and control systems, Skyview into Switzerland. That would go down as well. Key issue, I think, is if these reports are correct, and they seem to be very well sourced, very consistently sourced, the full announcement may be due in a week and a half or so. But if these things are true, what's the read across to Finland and to Canada, where we've got many of the same competitors involved? Boeing can't afford to lose very many more F-18 legacy operators. Both Finland and Canada are F-18 legacy operators. You know, I would argue that they need to win at least one of those. And you know, given the Boeing attack on the Bombardier C series, they're not necessarily flavor of the year, even flavor of the decade in Canada.
Richard, Ron, any comments you guys want to add to that? Ultimately, I think the F-35 program looks at it that we're going to keep competing in these markets until we're no longer competing in them. But Richard and Ron, and then very quickly want to get your comments on Willie Walsh and air taxis, because, hey, they're newsworthy and it's not like anybody here has a lot of passion on either of those issues. Go ahead.
You know, I think this has been a long 20-30 year strategy by Dassault and Rafael to basically seize the market that would not be going with the F-35. You know, I think like every other legacy fighter manufacturer pre-F-35, they saw the writing on the wall and they said, well, you know, there's still a big part of the market that will not be going down the F-35 path, and we're going to dominate it. And, you know, the trend has been their friend, whether it's the geopolitics of, you know, people wanting a second source of weapon provider, particularly in the Middle East or India, or people who just simply don't need an F-35, like Switzerland. And Rafael has, I think, a superb decade or more ahead. Basically fulfilling that strategy they embarked upon a quarter century ago.
Richard, why don't we start off with you? We don't have a lot of time, so I'm going to let you lead on this because I know that you're not passionate about your view about the stupidity of supersonic travel for regularly scheduled service or for business travel or air taxis, which was a big story, obviously, in the New York Times about the rush for that. Willie Walsh, former, the very shy, a man who does not part with opinions easily, former chief of IAG, parent company of, among other airlines, British Airways, has made his verdict on United Airlines' decision to buy Overture jets from Boom Supersonic. What do you make of his comments?
Yeah, shy and retiring indeed. You know, I think anyone who's in the airline business or understands the airline business knows that this was basically just a PR stunt, a little theater, and not much more. And you know, the reason, of course, which in Willie Walsh's case is rooted in BA's operational experience over many decades. They have learned from bitter experience that when you have a plane with 80, 90, 100 people, whatever, and you need to fill it with basically full fare business or full fare first passengers, then yeah, you could put a few on a few routes pretty much overnight. You know, New York, London, great, make it happen. And then what do you do for an encore? And how does it fit in with a large network air carrier, especially one that depends on 6 or 12 or 15 passengers on so many of its other routes, but which can't fit a 90-seat jet or an 80-seat jet on those routes with that type of passenger? It just quickly becomes obvious that the whole idea is basically nonsense. If there is going to be supersonic transport in the civil realm, it's going to be in the corporate jet arena. And despite Aireon's failure, I still think it might just happen one day. But from a scheduled network air carrier standpoint, it's just kind of brain dead, frankly.
From a BA standpoint, they would have argued they were making money on the New York, London, as well as London to Bermuda runs, where the airplanes were running somewhat full. It was the French that were actually less successful because they would do prestige routes as opposed to pure revenue routes. Ron, do you want to make any comment on air taxi before I toss it to the other two to finish up? Any any key takeaways
One observation I would make. Everyone can throw tomatoes at me on this, but if you look at what United is doing, and you know, clearly there's a PR aspect to it, but you know, they cut a deal with Archer for air taxis. You know, they did this thing with Boom. I think if you stand back and look at United, they're trying to put together this concept that we've heard many times from different folks over the years, where we can, you know, air taxi you to the hub, move you from one hub to another hub, potentially get you someplace far away very fast, and then air taxi you again on the other side.
Right.
who knows if it's going to work. But it's interesting that you have an airline kind of, at least conceptually, putting that out there. Now, ultimately, there's all kinds of things that have to happen for that actually to happen. But, I do have to applaud that, they're trying to put together this broader vision that we've heard about in the past, and who knows if it's going to work. But just on the front of innovation and maybe even dreaming about a future that could be, I have to applaud them for that.
I would say it is a systemic approach to it. Sash, you get the last word.
The more I've looked at Boom and Overture this week, the more I think that every single thing about it is everything about it is underestimated, apart from the claims for connectivity, which are grossly overstated. You're absolutely right. The issue with Concorde is it only made money on one and a half, two routes. I remember London, Washington, DC as well. And for Boom to work, they've got to sell genuinely a ton or two of aircraft, probably a couple of hundred. The productivity of supersonic business jets, if they're operated correctly, is ferocious. They just suck up every single bit of premium traffic. Even if the environmental issues could be dealt with, even if Boom is the right company to develop this thing in 8.5 years, and I think that timescale is ludicrous, verging on irresponsible. Boeing and Airbus can't develop a narrow body in that time. No way Boom can develop a supersonic business jet in that time. Even if they can develop it at a price that is just somewhere in the mid-teens of billions, and they can find the money for that, I don't think that there are enough routes with enough premium traffic. And you talk about business class. Concorde was first class plus in terms of its pricing. Right. So this has got to be an astonishing product, and it's not. It's vaporware at the moment.
And before we go, Ron, 30 seconds, talk about the Archer rollout. You visited it while you were out in California.
Yeah. I attended the Archer rollout. It was a lot of fun. They rolled out the what they call the Maker aircraft, which is a test vehicle essentially. Went through some of the specs of the vehicle, so on and so forth, and gave a virtual demonstration of what's going on, and then we got to poke around on the aircraft or whatever. It was interesting. It was different.
And tell the audience what the Archer is for those people who don't know what it is.
Yeah, so Archer is one of the eVTOL eVTOL companies, developers. They're the one who sold aircraft to United. They have an eVTOL design that's based on distributed power, distributed rotors with a fixed wing, right? So it's kind of, imagine sort of like a V-22 with distributed rotors. So you can get some range out of it. And they would like to bring it to market, I think, by 2024, if I remember correctly. But what was interesting about it, having gone to other rollouts, it was a very different kind of rollout. When we've gone to the rollout of the 787 and the rollout, several Embraer rollouts over the years, this had more of a tech spin to it. And the community, the eVTOL community, has really been seeded out of Silicon Valley as opposed to Seattle or Toulouse, it had a different feel, had a different group of people there, but it's always exciting to see a new aircraft roll out, and can't wait to see it go through its tests. And again, this is just a test vehicle to test some of the technologies that are going to go on the ultimate vehicle that they end up delivering.
All right, guys, thanks very much. Really appreciate it. It's always a pleasure having you guys on. Have a great weekend and a great week, and we look forward to having you back on again next week. Thanks a lot.
Great to be here, Vago. Thank you.
Thank you, Vago. Always a pleasure.
Thanks, Vago. Great to be here.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.